Greetings. I'm Austin Egbert, the director of Mind Matters News. Welcome to another special BingeCast episode, where multiple interviews are fused into a single program. Today's BingeCast features a talk with Professor Brian Thomas on his experiences in aiding developing countries through the use of appropriate technologies. Enjoy.
Welcome to Mind Matters News, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head-on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Greetings. This is Mind Matters, where we talk about artificial intelligence and natural intelligence. We know a lot about AI in developed countries like the United States and Western Europe. We know about the concerns of self-driving trucks replacing truck drivers. We know about robots maybe taking the employment away from factory workers. But what about AI and technology in developing countries? What is the best way to introduce technology into developing countries? These countries that are developing don't need faster computers. They need technology which is appropriate for them, so-called appropriate technology. And today we have as a guest Brian Thomas, who is a practitioner of appropriate technology. Professor Thomas is a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Baylor. He is the faculty in residence at Thiel Residential College, where undergraduate engineering and computer science students eat, live, and learn together. Professor Thomas is also the founder and current faculty advisor of an incredible award-winning student organization named Engineers with a Mission. Brian, let me start right out. How can technology be appropriate or inappropriate, especially for a developing country?
Technology is appropriate or inappropriate to the extent that it can be used in the culture in which it's intended to be used. And by used, it doesn't just mean operate. I don't just mean operate. I also mean repair, maintain, afford. Is it economically appropriate? Is it culturally appropriate? Does it offend people? Is it appropriate to the religious and cultural norms in which it's embedded? And some of those cultural norms are not so subtle, like the tendency of a culture to perform maintenance and perform repairs. Or do they just let things go until they break?
I have heard, and I can't cite the source, about engineers and scientists that went into a third world country and were excited to increase the number of harvests that they had in a year from, for example, two harvests to three harvests.
Okay.
And they thought this would be great because now the natives had 50% more food to eat, and they thought everybody would be happy, but the natives were really, really upset. And the reason they were upset was because it interfered with their tradition of festivals. They had harvest festivals yearly. So I think this kind of talks about your comments about the cultural matching, if you will, with the technology.
Yes, I heard a story, and I like to tell this story in class about and I believe it was in Sudan, a nonprofit organization saw these women bending over to wash their clothes in the river, and they thought, wouldn't it be nice if they had some kind of washing stand where they could stand upright and wash their clothes. So they built some kind of concrete structure with some kind of piped water where the women could stand around and wash their clothes without having to bend over. And it was a big success. Everybody loved it. And so they decided, well, let's replicate it in other parts of the country. And they went to some other parts of the country to do the same thing, and they weren't used. Or what would happen is one woman would come up and wash her clothes, and then when she was finished, the next one would. But it was designed to be a multi-person facility. Why was this?
Oh, so they kind of had a kiosk there in
yes.
a way.
Yeah, that, right,
where,
right.
Where everybody washed
maybe
their clothes.
Three or four people could stand around. And they did some research, and they finally found out the reason. In the first area where this laundry kiosk, if you will, was successful, was a Christian area. And the women had no problem getting together, and in fact, they enjoyed the social interaction of talking while they were working. But in the other area, the second area was a Muslim area, and there were cultural inhibitions about washing your clothes in front of other people, especially perhaps your underwear or underwear.
I would
of
have
family.
A problem with that. Yes.
Okay. And so that's why only one woman would use it at a time. So what they did was they built smaller laundry stands and spaced them around, 10 or 15 feet apart, so they could still have conversation and still do laundry together, but there was a measure of privacy that way, and then it was accepted.
So the point is it just introduction of a technology into a developing country can't be done in isolation. It has to be taken into consideration of the cultural and religious and
we
ceremonial background.
Assume that because it works in our culture, it will work in another culture.
Right.
In fact, that's a guarantee for failure.
Okay.
There's lots of grain grinding mills around sub-Saharan Africa that are no longer used because they've broken down from lack of maintenance and lack of repair. Maybe in the United States, they would be repaired and would be maintained so that we can continue to use them as a labor-saving device. Well, the money for that was not available. The culture of repair is going to be linked to your assumption that you have dominion over nature.
Oh, really? So it's kind of a religious or a cultural thing?
Yes. And I've heard one person describe it, if you imagine an axis of fatalism, that the more fatalistic a culture, the less likely they are to make repairs. For example, animism, where we might say, and I'm not going to be an expert in animism, but if you imagine that the world is controlled by chaotic spirits at war with one another, why are you going to spend money repairing your machine? Because the only reason it breaks is because some spirits beyond your control made it break. If, however, you believe that we have dominion over nature, then you're going to make repairs to that system because you know that those repairs will not be a waste of time. And so what we find is the Judeo-Christian worldview makes repairs and maintenance of technological systems more effectively.
Okay. I know in talking to you before we started talking, or I learned before we started talking, that there's actually, number one, different flavors of so-called appropriate technology, and number two, it has quite a history in terms of what's happening. Could you speak to that a little bit?
I can. I'll have to say I'm not an expert on it, but from my understanding in the late 70s, there was a movement called the Appropriate Technology Movement. And
really?
The idea was that if people in poor countries can be shown how to build simple technologies, low technologies instead of high technologies, things that they could build and manufacture and recreate at the village level with limited tools and know-how, that those, if we could develop such technologies that would be helpful to their lifestyle, generate income, perhaps even labor-saving devices, that those would be naturally propagate from village to village. So if you can learn how
to... So this would be, for example, maybe a place where there were lots of coconuts, if they could figure out how to build their houses out of coconut hulls.
Exactly.
Then that could be something which could propagate to the rest of the country if they figured out a good way to do
that. If someone, a third party NGO or a university could develop
NGO is
a non-government organization, a nonprofit organization in the United States. We call it a nonprofit here. Some do-gooder organization, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, develops the idea, maybe teaches the first people how to do it, and then it catches on and gets perfected and it's a money-making device, and it generates income for this village, which naturally causes the folks in the next village to want to do the same, and it propagates that way. That was the original idea.
How successful was it?
Not very successful. Martin Fisher of Kickstarter is a man. He's got a...
That was an NGO?
Kickstarter is the name of his NGO, yes.
Okay.
And he's got his degree from Stanford, PhD in mechanical engineering, and began looking at this problem in the late 80s. And one of the conclusions he reached was that manufacturing is not going to be done at the village level. The manufacturing needs to be done in city centers or urban areas in the proximity of these local villages. And then we worry about building supply chains to distribute the technologies. That's a more effective solution. So that's not necessarily, I guess you could say that that's a different type of appropriate technology, or it's a change in the thinking of appropriate technology. So you could, one is, let's summarize that. One idea of appropriate technology is some kind of device or devices or processes that can be repeated and replicated at the village level, and then will propagate naturally from village to village. Another idea is to develop a part that can be, or a device rather, like say a pump or an irrigation device that can be manufactured at in urban areas, like perhaps in machine shops. Maybe you need a welder, maybe you need a machinist to help put the thing together. And then to develop supply chains that distribute those items, typically for sale, to improve people's lives.
Well, one of the things, another flavor, I think, would be something called, I've heard it called sustainable technology, wherein one goes in and helps economically to develop a natural resource where the natives, the nationals, can actually take over and actually run a thriving business. I'm familiar, for example, with this being attempted for coconuts. And coconuts grow in a lot of the undeveloped countries, especially around the equator. And that's a natural resource that can be exploited not only for the coconut as a food and as an oil, but also the husks of coconuts. If you've ever tried to crack one, they're pretty rough.
They are. They're very tough.
They're very, very tough. So that says, man, there's something there in that coconut hull that I should be able to use. So I think there was an attempt there for that. The idea is that it is sustainable in the sense that you go in, the business starts, and hopefully it assists human flourishing.
Yes, that's right. You've got to... anybody that goes in with an unsustainable model these days is not taken seriously. You've got to have it economically stable or economically sustainable, meaning it's going to generate enough income on its own to sustain itself.
Okay.
It cannot rely on an endless supply of donations.
Okay.
I can give you another example of this. This may be the best example I've got yet.
Okay. You're getting better and better.
Yeah, I'm warming up. Okay. There's a fellow that I met, an American, and he was working in Honduras, and he bought 500 acres in rural Honduras with the feeling of God calling him to build an orphanage. So he realized that orphanages often run on donations, and he could harness his network in the United States and his own personal wealth, and he could put in donations to build and to maintain this orphanage. But what he studied them, and he found that if you build an orphanage to, say, house 100 kids, that the donations will dry up after a while. Mm-hmm. They start with a surge, but then they diminish. And then once they diminish, then the orphanage can no longer maintain 100 children. Maybe it can only maintain 30 children. And so now we have this oversized building and an underutilized resource because it's running on donations. So he wanted to do things differently. And on this large purchase of land, he built palm trees and he built tanks, large tanks for growing tilapia, the fish, which is a popular food source and export in Honduras.
I think I get that at the coffee shop where I go for lunch on Saturday.
Yeah, yeah.
They have them there, right? They're kind of a white fish. You don't know. Okay. Really know. I think my wife said that those are raised externally. Raised externally. They're raised outside of the U.S. and imported.
Yeah, they are imported. The United States imports a lot. We import, I think, a lot of ours from China, at least when I've read the packages at H-E-B.
Okay. H-E-B, if you're not from Texas, is like Kroger or Walmart. It's kind of a high-class Walmart, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Emphasis more on groceries and less on apparel and auto parts. Well, let's see, where were we? So this fellow, he built an orphanage in Honduras, and instead of doing it with donations, what he did was he used a surge of donations at the beginning to build a sustainable business, and that was building tilapia tanks and systems of growing large, you know, piping in fresh water and aerating the tanks and all this. Was a very big production, and then he sells for profit the tilapia and also the palm oil that he grows on the facility, and uses those profits to run the orphanage instead of using the donations to run the orphanage. And that way he's got a more sustainable model.
I've heard about that. It's a self-contained unit wherein you grow plants and you have worms and the My wife calls it worm tea, which is kind of the liquid that worms make.
Worm in your tea. No, we don't have worm fish tea. Fish in your coffee.
Yeah, exactly. But the worm tea from the growing crops kind of goes into the water and supplies nourishment for the fish, and it's kind of a self-contained universe.
Yes, those are beautiful little systems. I think the system that we were working with this guy was he had if you're growing several thousand tilapia, then you make a lot of fish poop. And so what do you do with all that fish poop? And we were trying to help him do a biodigester to generate methane from the fish sewage.
That would be a really appropriate technology. Well, Professor Thomas, our time is up. I want to continue because there's some other things that I want to ask you maybe in another episode. One of them is actually the impact of AI, specifically cell phones, on some of the third world countries. We hear a lot about Malawi and the fact that they were an undeveloped country. The cell phone came in and it just propagated all over the place. The current CEO of Microsoft is all excited about dumping AI sort of technology into developing countries. And also, I want to hear about some of the things that you've done. I know that you've taken what seems to be things we take for granted, such as white light LEDs, to different places to help them in an appropriate technology sense, and maybe some of the other projects that you've done with Engineers with a Mission. So we'll talk about that next. Well, Brian, last time we were talking about the different flavors of AI and some stories about introduction of appropriate technology into different countries. This time I'd like to talk a little bit more about what you are doing. You have founded and continue to be the faculty advisors to Engineers with a Mission. And could you talk about that a little bit? What is Engineers with a Mission? Yeah. When and why did you found Engineers with a Mission? How long has it been going, and what are some of the stuff you're doing?
Well, we founded as an official Baylor student organization, essentially a club, back in 2004. So we've got several years behind us now. The purpose of bringing it together was to help engineering students realize that they can use their engineering skill set to serve the poorest of the poor, to reach out in a Christian capacity to the developing world, to hurting people abroad, to people that are trapped in poverty, people that Jesus Christ talks about caring for very much. How do we be engineers for the other 90%? And not just engineers for the relatively wealthy West.
Yeah, to interrupt, for those that don't know, Baylor University is a Baptist university, and it's a private university, and therefore still embraces Christian sort of ideologies and missions.
Yeah.
Do you think that this idea of helping the poor and downtrodden is a widespread concern at Baylor among the—
Yes, it is. And I'd say it's widespread nationwide. I think a lot of it has to do with the millennial generation is very civic-minded and other-oriented. Mm-hmm. I think part of that is in response to growing up with social media, where you and I, as children, saw pictures in National Geographic magazine of people living in poor conditions around the world. This generation actually knows people. They've become friends with people around the world, and because it becomes personal, they care more. Mm-hmm. That's my theory about why they care more. But whether that is accurate or not, they definitely are more civic minded. Surveys have shown that. Here at Baylor, there's a large group of students that come in and say, I feel like I'm called to the ministry, but you know what? I'm good at math and science. What do I do? And so
I don't think a congregation wants to hear a pastor derive a bunch of theorems.
Right? No, exactly. But they think, well, what can I do? I can't perhaps lead music, or I can't perhaps preach a sermon. But you know what I can do is I can develop a hydropower system for generating electricity for a remote rural village. Wow. Well, that has its place. There's a breadth of the kingdom of God. There's a breadth of the body of Christ that is needed and wanted and celebrated. And so we want to help students find their vocations, recognize their callings, and move towards those here. That's one of the things that the club is trying to do, is trying to help students by exposing them to the idea that engineering in general can be used in a human flourishing sense, in a Christian missions support sense.
So you founded Engineers with a Mission in 2003. I understand that the demand for joining Engineers with a Mission is relatively high among
it's a very
the
popular group. Technical and, group. And I think it's a popular student organization because they do have that other-mindedness. You know, essentially they want to do something good. They want to do something significant with their lives. They want to do something that impacts people that they see suffering and hurting.
Okay.
And that was my own experience. In 2003, I traveled to Iraq, and I went with a group of Baylor faculty. Fighting had just ceased, but before the insurgency had really begun. In fact, we were sitting in the airport watching. The day we left for Iraq was the day they discovered Saddam Hussein hiding in his little hole.
rat hole.
Yeah, we were watching him and, you know, do news coverage of that while we were waiting in the airport to go there. And on that trip, I saw poverty that I'd never seen before, and it changed me. And so that's one of the things that—
How did it change you? What sort of poverty, for example? What sort of human situations got your attention?
Seeing, I guess, just the rural villages in which people lived, with their obvious lack of services, water, sewage, electricity, and just imagining myself thinking how difficult would life be if I had been born there instead of where I was born. And I think it created in me or cultivated in me a compassion and an empathy that perhaps was there, but now had new purpose and new focus.
Well, I know that you take a group of students every year, I think. One major trip to a developing country, and you then introduce technology which is appropriate and will help those countries. Could you talk about some
of
those?
That's right. We have an annual trip, and sometimes we do two trips. We've been to Kenya and Honduras, but lately we've been working in Haiti the last several years. And the idea is to take students on a trip where they can be exposed to the idea of using their engineering skills to help the poor, or the global poor, but also to make a real difference, make a real positive difference in the lives of the people that we are endeavoring to serve. So, for example, our most recent trips have been to establish solar electricity systems for a Haitian-run Christian nonprofit organization in Haiti. And we have come alongside this group that's doing good on its own. It's local in the sense of it's run by Haitians. It was run by Haitian former orphans who are now in their 30s and 40s and are successful in various careers. And they decided, hey, that orphanage that we grew up in saved our lives. Let's make our own. And so they built an orphanage. They built a school. They built a hospital. And we've been helping them with their energy needs because they live off the location of these orphanage, school, and hospital are off the electrical grid in Haiti. And even if they were connected to the electrical grid in Haiti, they would have intermittent connections.
They don't have the best infrastructure in the world in Haiti,
no,
do they?
No, that's of course, why the earthquake was so devastating, because their lack of infrastructure
was your trip was after tragic. The earthquake?
Yes, we've continued to do trips. My first trip was after several years after the earthquake, and we've continued to go. I picked up some Haitian Creole, and
so you can speak the language, huh? Okay. So you helped this organization set up solar panels so that they could
Orphanage and school was running on a diesel generator because they are not connected to, you know, the city grid power. They had a large diesel generator that someone had donated, but they were spending a whole lot of money on diesel fuel to keep the place running. And what that meant was they spent not only a lot of their budget, but they only had electricity for 3 to 6 hours a day when they turned the generator on. So we worked with them to install a solar photovoltaic system on the roof of their orphanage. It's about a 3-kilowatt system. We also included battery storage so they could store the energy that they captured during the day. And then they could use that energy for lights and fans generally in the evening. And that way they save fuel, don't have to run the diesel generator, and it impacts their budget and their quality of life, actually, because they're able to actually use more electricity than they would have otherwise and use it for all kinds of productive purposes. Okay. So the next year, we went back and tried it. We're now actually in the middle of the project, replicating the same idea for the hospital. They built a brand new hospital. It's a beautiful facility. It's one of the best ones I've seen in Haiti. And they're spending more money per month, $2,500, in fact, on diesel fuel than they are. They're spending more on that than they are on doctors' salaries. It's the largest line item in their budget.
Okay.
So we are in the middle of putting a very large 15 kilowatt system onto that facility that will help with their energy costs significantly.
Fascinating. I also know that you took a trip to, I believe it was someplace in Central America, where you used a Nobel Prize winning invention to help an orphanage. It turns out that in 2014, Akasaki, Amano, and Nakamura won the Nobel Prize in Physics for invention of the efficient blue light emitting diode, which has made possible the bright and energy saving white light sources. I know I have one on my phone and I can use it for a flashlight. One of these little LEDs, white light LEDs. This is pretty recent technology and, they're incredibly efficient. They don't get hot.
That's right. If you are watching every joule of energy that you harvest with a solar panel, or even if you generate it with a diesel generator, if you're very conscious of all the energy you use, then you want to use it in the most effective way possible. That's part of being an appropriate solution, is an effective use of the energy. Now, you might argue that in the United States, we should be using our energy more effectively and efficiently. And I would agree with that, but it's even more important when you have a very limited amount of energy in the first place. So white LEDs create the same amount of light for much less energy consumption than even compact fluorescent bulbs, or certainly the standard old incandescent bulb. So we want to use white LED technology for lighting whenever possible. However, there's also the question of appropriateness comes up again. And white LEDs may be appropriate, more appropriate from an energy point of view, but what about from an availability point of view? If they fail, what do I do? Well, I can't go down in Honduras to the local drugstore and buy a white LED light, but I can go down and buy a compact fluorescent. So we have to think, these are the types of considerations we make, the cultural appropriateness considerations we have to make when we're designing a system in that environment.
Now, you went to an orphanage, is that right? And installed LEDs at the orphanage?
Well, actually, no. You're mixing continents and projects.
I'm okay.
Yeah, we did a white LED project in Kenya. In the Kibera slum of Nairobi, a very infamous place without access to good electricity or lighting. And we did a white LED lighting project where I think about a dozen homes or so received power. And because of the limited amount of energy that we could create, we wanted to make sure that we used it very effectively. And we used white LED lighting for that purpose.
Now, in order to power the LEDs, I think you use car batteries, is that right?
Well, no, we use a deep cycle battery, which functions similarly to a car battery in that it's a lead acid battery, but it's designed to be able to discharge at a deeper level than a car battery. So if you imagine the amount of energy stored in a car battery, like a glass of water, for an automobile, those batteries are designed to only take out the first 5% or so of the water. A deep cycle battery would be a type of glass, so to speak, that you could drink dry and then refill.
I see. And how did you recharge these batteries?
Solar panels or small wind turbine systems. So actually, we've even done a system where we use a diesel generator to recharge batteries while we worked on building a small hydropower generator that would be the long-term solution.
I see. Okay. And I know you've also done some things which really aren't high technology. Bridge building, for example, I thought was a very interesting story. Could you talk about this?
Yes.
This isn't AI. This is not computer technology, but I think it was very appropriate for what you did and when you did it.
Yes. It was in 2005 in Kenya in support of another organization called Bridging the Gap Africa. And the fellow in Bridging the Gap Africa, I forget his name, but essentially goes around different parts of the world putting in pedestrian bridges. So there was one particular pedestrian bridge where a village lived on both sides of a river. And the bridge that was existing had been washed away in a storm, and now the two sides were isolated. And the school and the access to market roads was on one side, and the other side was very much isolated.
Really?
So what did they do?
So it's kind of like the Berlin Wall going up.
It was a little bit. So yeah. You're faced with choices. Now you can swim across the river, but people drowned, and even perhaps more surprisingly for your listeners, hippos are a danger. And so they lurk under the water. Yes, they're very – actually, more people die from hippopotamus attacks than alligators, I believe. Or crocodiles.
What country is this again?
That statistic was global, but I was working in Kenya.
Okay. My goodness.
So you have to either swim across in a dangerous situation, or you have to go for a long walk to get to the nearest bridge, which may have been 5 miles down the river, which means 5 miles down the river, cross the bridge, 5 miles comes back to go to school, and then you got to do it again on the way home. So it's a 20-mile round trip. So Bridging the Gap Africa is a nonprofit that is putting in pedestrian bridges. They have a very low tech, very simple design that can be deployed without machinery. And by machinery, I mean things like cranes that you still need hand tools. But with simple hand tools, you could deploy this bridge, and they did so and spanned this river, connecting these two sides of the village. And our students on that trip got to be part of that and join in the celebration afterwards, where the two sides were reunited.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Just like the Berlin Wall being knocked down, except the bridge was being built.
Yes, the same idea.
Okay.
Hippos.
That's fascinating. Any other projects that you want to share?
Well, okay, one more.
Okay.
There's an orphanage we worked in Honduras that was raising a lot of tilapia fish to generate
that
income.
That I get at my coffee shop buffet.
Right.
Yes.
Maybe. And tilapia, then, you know, these are live animals, of course, so they're being fed every day and they're pooping every day. And so what do you do with, thousands of gallons of tilapia poop? And the answer is, well, what if we could build a methane digester to let this naturally be processed, or let the fish sewage be processed by natural bacteria that produce methane gas as a natural byproduct? Then if we harvest that methane gas, we could cook with it, or we could I use it for generating electricity in a methane burning generator. Unfortunately, that project was a failure.
Oh, was it?
Yeah,
what happened?
We had trouble getting the gas production cycle, because it is a natural process. We couldn't get it started.
Okay.
So if we had more time, we may have been able to do it, but in the amount of time we had, we were unable to get it started. So
you got an A for effort,
as they
say. Okay. Let me ask you something, and this is, I think, a segue into our third and final talk with Professor Thomas, is about use of cell phones. Have you noticed in your visiting of any of these countries uses of cell phones that didn't exist before? Because before cell phones, you have to have a significant infrastructure in order to talk on the telephone. You had to lay wires and all of that other stuff. But with cell phones, the poster country is Malawi. You don't need that. You put up a tower and you sell people these cheap cell phones, and they're off and communicating with each other. Have you seen evidence of that?
I've seen that everywhere I've been.
Is that right?
And it's been remarkable, because exactly, you know, we're surprised by it in the United States, because we had landlines first, and we expect that other cultures would have to get a thriving landline system before they would jump to cellular, but there's no reason for that. Instead, some people refer to this as leapfrog technology, where one technology, in this case cellular telephony, leapfrogs landlines to move ahead. It's easier to deploy from an infrastructure point of view. You can drop a guy down from a helicopter with a chainsaw, and he can build a landing pad and come back and build a tower there and put it on solar panels, and now you've got a cell site.
Now, did they do that? Did they drop a guy in that
builds?
Well,
these are the stories I hear.
Okay, these are – because if they do, that's really fascinating.
I mean, that's a good gig.
That would be a good scene in a movie.
Yeah.
It really would.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then the cell phone usage, you don't need much to be able to communicate. You don't have to have the latest iPhone to be able to have a significant impact on your life when you go from no phone to some phone. All you have to do is be able to send a text message to someone, a simple message, a cheap message to send. And you can inquire about market prices, and you can find out that if you're selling your corn, that Village A is giving a better price than Village B.
Well, I tell you what, Professor Thomas, we're out of time right now. I'd like to continue this because I want to specifically talk next time about the use of cell phones in developing countries. I want to talk about the current CEO of Microsoft, Satya Nadella, in his new book, Hit Refresh. And he talks about pouring technology, high technology, into third world countries. I'd like to get your take on that. And so we'll talk about that next time. Today, I would like to talk about the broader impact of potential AI in these developing countries. Satya Nadella, he's the CEO of Microsoft, and he wrote a book called Hit Refresh. Nadella laments in 2 years, only 16% of the world's poorest population, and overall only 55% of the world's population will have access to the internet. Poor us. At the current rate, he says we won't have near 100% access until 25 years from now. Cell phone use is likewise on the rise in many developing countries, allowing greater communication. He notes Malawi, one of Africa's former poorest countries, has been revitalized in the last decade in the use of cell phones. So, Professor Thomas, we were talking at the end of the last podcast how in your visits you have seen cell phones in use in third world countries. And could you talk a little bit about what your assessment of the impact of the cell phone introduction has been?
Well, I haven't studied it formally, but I have seen everywhere I've been, there have been cell phone users. And sometimes these are often people that may not even have electricity in their homes, but they have a cell phone. And so you may ask, how does one charge a cell phone if you don't have electricity?
Good question.
Well, yeah. Let's say, Bob, you're my neighbor, and I hear that you're going into town next week to buy a new machete at the hardware store. I'm going to give you my phone and a little money. And while you're there, I want you to find an outlet and plug in my phone and charge it up for me and bring it back when you come back the next day. And I'll pay you for it. Or if we're family, then maybe you'll do it for me for free. Another possibility is that someone has a small solar panel in their home and is able to charge. And so there are cell phone charging businesses in the world whose whole purpose is to charge people's cell phones. In fact, we helped start such businesses in Haiti by putting in a single solar panel in some poor people's homes and establishing a network of small family businesses where...
So people can bring their cell phones to these poor homes and get them recharged.
That's right.
And the people at the poor home make a few pennies.
They do. And I forget what the rates were, but there was a significant increase in income. And I'm one of our most successful business owners, a woman named Sonia. And she was operating a cell phone business. And we went to check on her a year later, and it was great because just as we were pulling up, one of her customers was leaving, having just had her cell phone charged and paid. And we went inside and we looked at the system. And one of the innovations we saw that she had implemented was she didn't have the right charger for everyone's cell phone. And so what she had done is taken the charger apart, and she would, if you bring your phone in, she will take the battery out and directly connect it to the wires coming from the charger instead of using a little adapter or something like that. And she would charge the batteries individually without any type of adapter, just a direct connection of the wires. And then once it was all charged, she'd put it back in your phone for you and give it back to you.
So I know that the cell phones that are used in third world countries are not made by Apple or
Samsung.
Mm-hmm. They're not made by Apple or Samsung, but rather they are manufactured elsewhere, and they're not as good of quality. They don't have the flexibility that the cell phones you and I are familiar with.
Yes, there's a mixture. I've seen iPhones in Haiti. They sometimes are a model or two older. Maybe sometimes they've been given by, you know, visiting Americans. But you're right. There is also a large class of cell phones that is manufactured elsewhere. And so we're talking about being able to buy a cell phone for about $25 and having a prepaid system where you don't even have to, there's no hookup charge. There's no, I mean, you have to buy a SIM card, but after that, you pay on a pay per use basis. So if you need to use your phone, you can go down to the local store, buy a little card with a scratch off number, enter the number into your phone, and now you've got, you know, 30 minutes of credit.
Oh, really?
Okay, right. It's prepaid. Right. And when you run out of credit, the conversation stops, sometimes abruptly in the middle of your important negotiation.
Oh, my goodness.
A lot of the systems are also made where you can you can continue to receive calls, but you can only make calls, place calls, if you have credit. Also, texting takes less bandwidth than a phone call, so a lot of people will just text because it's cheaper. And sometimes, if I'm in my last few cents of credit, then I might send you a text and say, Bob, call me, because I don't have enough credit to call you and tell you I need to talk to you. But I can send you a text because it only costs.
So poor people are texting the rich people to give them a call if they want to talk to them, right?
Yes.
Interesting.
And it's a very – often a lot of these places, in fact, just about everywhere compared to the United States, is a more communal – community-oriented culture, less individualistic. And so there's even a way to send credit to your friends. So I can say, hey, Bob, I'm out of cell phone credit. Can you send me some? And you can enter a special code and my phone number into your phone, and it beams credit over to my phone. And now I can basically use that however I want.
That is so interesting.
Yeah, these cell phones, they provide access to market data. If you make your living selling corn that you raised on your 2-acre farm, then you want to know whether, you know, which city is offering the best price for that corn, and whether or not you're getting a good deal, or if you're in isolation, you can't communicate. You don't know what the running prices of things are. People can take advantage of you. But if you know that what the market price is for a particular product, then you're empowered and you can not be taken advantage of.
So it helps with the invisible hand of free enterprise.
I suppose it does. Yes.
Okay. One of the things that Nadella says is that in 25 years, he believes that the world will have nearly 100% access to the internet. I'm going to ask you to put on a prophet hat now and ask you, what would be the impact of access to the internet to the sort of countries that you've visited?
Well, I know that there's an appetite for cat videos no matter where
you
go.
For what kind of videos?
Cat videos.
Cat?
Yeah. Don't you want cat videos?
Oh, of cute little kittens and things?
Yeah.
Okay. No, I'm not a big fan of cat videos.
Well, that's the best use of the internet.
Are there cell phones available to do that, to tether to the internet so that they can watch things on it? Or?
Yes, there are. My experience has been that the cellular connection is the weak link. Not the fact that I have a phone in my hand that is capable of streaming video, but that the cellular backbone in the country is not sufficient for me to do that. So when I'm in Haiti, for example, and I work in Cap Haitian on the northern coast, I can't really access internet or even make phone calls during the maybe from 5 p.m. to 10 p.m. because everyone is trying to use it at that time, and the whole system is overloaded, and you just can't get through. So what I'll often do is send a text message, and then I'll put my phone on my nightstand and go to bed. And in the morning, I find that sometime during the night, my phone was able to access the cellular network and send my text message.
You know, I had heard of this I think it was a Boy Scout retreat where they couldn't get cell phone service. So what they did is they took a helium balloon, they attached the cell phone to it and raised it up about, I don't know, 100 feet or something like that. And all the text messages downloaded. And so they could pull it back. Oh, and not only did the messages download, but the ones that they have typed the previous night before uploaded.
Yeah.
So next time you go to Haiti, take a helium balloon with you. And you might be more successful.
Well, I tell you, one time we were coming back from a nearby town. I had a driver who had his own vehicle from the Dominican Republic, and we had driven over to a town to buy some PVC pipe, and we were coming back, and all of a sudden smoke started coming out of the dashboard, and, well, his car caught on fire. And so, after we got the car fire out, then we were trying to call for help because we couldn't get the car started again, and I had to go climb a hill, and once I got on the top of the hill, I could get cell service and I could call for help. But while I was standing down at the road level, I couldn't get it.
fascinating. Now, Nadella, Satya Nadella, the CEO of Microsoft, also said, he asked the question, how can we make technology available to everyone? And then I think that that's an interesting question. And then how can we ensure that it works to benefit everyone? So in the last one, he's kind of addressing the idea of appropriate technology. I can think of the cell phones and the internet as being something which might be appropriate for technology for these third world countries. What about other technology? Nothing really comes to mind in terms of artificial intelligence. Maybe a self-driving car would be really nice to have in the third world.
I don't know. That seems like a pretty let's go with the first question. Paul Pollack, who is pretty famous in development circles, has a few principles. One of his principles is miniaturization. So if you can't afford a horse, let's figure out a way to make a quarter of a horse, or an eighth of a horse, or a sixteenth of a horse. That's more affordable. And then with that fractional horse, I can earn income, use the profits to buy a second fractional horse, and eventually work my way up to that formerly prohibitive hurdle of buying a whole horse. Well, the idea with cell phones could be the same. You're going to need to make the technology, you're going to have to package it in small, inexpensive bits that can be added together or that are can be accumulated over time. That's one thing that's going to be necessary to bringing technology into poorer developing countries. And that also probably means we're going to have to give up some capability at first with these devices.
Have you seen any pushback from any of the cultures to uses of things like cell phones? I can't think of any, but I'm just wondering if you have.
I have not seen any person in the countries I've visited that was lamenting the invasion of cell phones or anything like that. Everyone, for example, well, I can't say the same about other American restaurants and other aspects of Western culture, but the cell phone penetration has been uniformly well received from my experience.
Okay. So nobody's bringing up any problems.
I have not seen that. Now, I have seen internet access, people that are concerned about gambling and pornography via internet access, but that's usually not done on a phone. It's more at a PC level.
And you didn't see very many PCs probably, or laptops.
Not too many. You have to go, again, it's kind of like the horse. If you can miniaturize the horse, it makes it more affordable. Well, what do you do to make the computer less and less expensive so it can be affordable? So anyway, they're not affordable often, and that means they're in internet cafes, businesses that where you don't actually own the PC, but someone else owns it, and you just come in and use it for a fee, for an hourly fee.
I wanted to get your reaction to an English journalist and renowned atheist, Matthew Paris. Paris was raised in Malawi and spent a lot of time around Christian missionaries, though. He went back to Malawi and he noticed some people that were building wells. So it was kind of appropriate technology. These were external, I believe, mission people that were building wells. And he noticed an incredible difference in the attitudes of those places which had been affected by the Christian missionaries and evangelism, as opposed to those that hadn't. And he said a very interesting statement, especially for an atheist, and I'm quoting now. He said, "Removing Christian evangelism from the African equation may leave the continent at the mercy of a malign fusion of Nike, the witch doctor, the mobile phone, and the machete." In other words, we're coming full circle because we're going back to what you talked about previously, is that in introducing new technology to a developing country, you can't just consider the technology. And you can't make the mistake, I think, that early missionaries did, that everybody should, the natives of the United States, the Native Americans should dress and act like Westerners.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. And so they tried to clothe them, which wasn't appreciated. And so there were these cultural clashes. So I'm wondering if you could talk about that a little bit more, about the cultural clashes, and maybe even Paris's idea that if you didn't have this cohesion, if you will, that it would be, I like this phrase. It'll be a fusion of Nike, the witch doctor, the mobile phone, and the machete. He said that he used to think that all
I think that's a great quote.
Isn't that a great quote? Why do you think it's great?
Because it touches on a lot of the real problems in developing countries. Let's start at the end, the machete. Gary Haugen is the founder of International Justice Mission. He's written a book called The Locust Effect, in which he discusses the nature of violence and the pervasiveness of violence in the developing world. He says, until we solve these problems of violence, our efforts to drill water wells and put in solar panels and things like this are missing the point, because they're going to be used and abused by people who are going to use violence to the strong that are able to use violence against the weak in developing countries. And so that technology just enables them to do it more effectively. So one of the things about the Christian worldview, about the big emphasis on loving your neighbor as yourself, has no room for violent acts of course theft and murder and sexual assault and all these other horrific problems that are part of the developing world, are all addressed in character reformation of the Christian worldview. The Christ is about rebuilding and reconciling these broken relationships between people, between humans and God, between humans and other humans, and even the relationships between that we have with ourselves, our self-understanding and our identity, and also with creation around us.
Well, this is interesting, because Paris actually said up to one time he would think that every tribal belief, and I guess he was talking about Malawi because that's where he was raised, but every tribal belief was in a relativistic sense equivalent to each other. Mm-hmm. And he has abandoned that and said, it isn't working. It isn't working. You still have this conflict. And it goes back to what you were talking about, of the strongest coming in and taking over this built infrastructure of high technology for political and personal gain.
Yes.
And exactly. That's what he was addressing. And I guess that's why he put the machete at the end of that.
Exactly. That's symbolic of interpersonal violence, and also even police violence and the abuse of power in general.
Have you noticed this in any places, either implicitly or explicitly?
This is more something that I've read about. In fact, Gary Haugen in his book talks about that even a seasoned visitor will typically not see these things because of two reasons. Both the victim and the perpetrator are trying very hard to hide it.
They're putting on their best face.
They're putting on their best face. Even the victim, because the victim doesn't want first of all, they're ashamed. They've been told it's their own fault. And they have no power to really combat the system, or combat the abuse, the violence, the sexual assault in court, because they don't have the money to pay the legal fees. Really, the money does go with the rich and powerful, or the rich become the powerful, rather, in these places. And there's a certain amount of immunity that they can get away with just about anything. I highly recommend The Locust Effect.
The book is The Locust Effect by, how do you spell his last
name? Gary Haugen, Haugen.
Okay, Haugen. Okay.
The other quotes we had up there were Nike. I think Nike symbolizes American free market economics. I'm not sure I would include the mobile phone up there with the machete and the witch doctor and Nike. I think the mobile phone is the most positive of those.
I don't think the list is necessarily of all negative things. It's just all of the things that are impacting what is happening. So I guess the witch doctor would correspond to the tribalism.
Tribalism, yeah. And what you were talking about earlier with the cultural norms of each culture. And let's, is each cultural norm an equivalent? Okay. Well, if so, that means the culture that practices female genital mutilation is equally valid as some others that are full of, kindness and compassion, for example. So that's an unsustainable viewpoint, I think. And when you see the transformative power of a unified worldview, like the Christian worldview, it comes in and it can transform entire individuals and, of course, cultures at large. And that's I think, what the essence of this quote is, that if there's no moral underpinning, then all we are left with is business and violence and tribalism.
Ravi Zacharias, who is a Christian apologist, said something which I think is in support of this. He says, all we have done, and I will insert in the development of high technology such as AI in both the developing world and the developed world, all we have done is being more sophisticated in the way we are destroying our culture. And this gets back, I think, to the idea of the infrastructure and these things being abused in terms of their use. We're seeing some of those. I don't want to mention Google or Facebook or anything, but there is the type of abuse that comes with that. So,
yeah, you've got to keep in mind that if your worldview thinks that humans are fundamentally good, then unleash the technology and it will be used for good. If your worldview, however, says that people are fundamentally flawed, maybe they're created good, but they're inherently flawed, then they're going to use that technology in selfish ways, perhaps in violent ways, and at least, as a minimum, as in self-serving ways. To the extent that we have a moral framework, we will use technology morally.
Excellent. Well, Professor Thomas, thank you for your time. We've been talking to Brian Thomas, a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Baylor University. He is also the founder and faculty advisor for Engineers with a Mission that takes technology appropriate to developing countries, and actually looks at implementing it there. So this is Mind Matters, and until next time, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.